I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. What causes creativity? Some might say it's a natural ability. Others say great training. But what about where it happens? Today we explore the geography of genius to see if there's a connection between a great idea and the place where it's born. Do places as different as ancient Athens and Silicon Valley have something in common when it comes to inspiration? Then we'll venture back to December of 1941, to one of the most horrific attacks this country has ever endured. We'll remember the history behind Japan's strike and hear how America was able to come back from devastation. We'll wrap things up with State House Blend, Kansas. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Think of a genius, and okay, I'm not suggesting that's me, and you might think of a wise person struggling alone in an attic somewhere, coming up with an invention that changes humankind. Eric Weiner took a close look at this idea of where genius comes from and developed a very different theory. After visiting some of the globe's most renowned centers of creative genius, he takes the idea of the lone wolf genius and tosses it out the window. Rather, Weiner concludes that lots of factors play into the creativity that made Florence, Edinburgh, Vienna, and modern-day Silicon Valley what they were or are. One of those factors, hardship. Eric Weiner's new book is The Geography of Genius, Lessons from the World's Most Creative Places. He's also the author of The Geography of Bliss and a former foreign correspondent for NPR. He joins us this morning by Skype from Washington, D.C. Eric, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What got you thinking about these centers of creative genius?
Well, I confess up front that I am a place person, as you can tell from the titles of my previous books.
Yeah.
I really do believe that place matters, that where we are affects who we are. And it affects who we are in terms of happiness, in terms of spirituality, and in terms of creative genius. It struck me as an area that was ripe for, let's say, a correction, because as you suggested in your introduction, you know, we have a lot of myths surrounding genius. You know, one is that geniuses are born. We really still cling to this notion that it's, you know, mostly genetic, mm-hmm. that, you know, Mozart playing the violin at age 3, and he must have been just born that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't doubt he had some innate talent, but he was also born in a very special time in a very special place in Salzburg in Austria in the 18th century. And I started to dig into this, and you look around the world at, you know, where geniuses have appeared, and if you plot them on a map, they don't appear randomly, you know, one in Kansas City and one in Siberia. They appear in groupings, in genius clusters, I call them. And, you know, whether it's ancient Athens in 450 BC or Florence in Italy in 1500 or Silicon Valley today, you know, genius is not sort of just randomly dispersed around the globe. So I would start to investigate, well, what is it about these places? What was in the water back then, and can we bottle it?
Hmm. Well, so again, this notion of the lonely genius that I mentioned in the intro, toiling away in an attic somewhere, it's been this popular conception of creative genius for forever. But again, what made you think that's not right?
Well, because, you know, when you start to look into the lives of geniuses, whether it be Socrates or Einstein or Steve Jobs, if you want to call him a genius, and that's up for debate, you realize that they may have had introvert tendencies. I don't deny that. But they were not recluses, not one of them really. What they do is they toggle between being sort of hyper-social and being hyper-alone. They go back and forth. But they almost always have some genius enablers, you might say, or co-geniuses, I call them, someone who helped them. Again, to stay with Steve Jobs, he had Steve Wozniak, who sort of filled in the gaps that Steve Jobs was missing. And time and again, you see this, either geniuses working in pairs or, you know, to go back to Mozart, geniuses who really had a whole city behind them. You know, Mozart came into his own in Vienna, and that was a place where music was literally in the air, and everyone was into it. Everyone played music and was a very particular audience, and I really think we underestimate the role of the audience in the whole genius process. It's not just that we passively let the genius wash over us. We play a role by who we choose to encourage and who we discourage.
You mentioned in the book a man named Dean Keith Simonton, who you point out was tan and fit when you talk to him. He got you thinking in a different way about genius. He studies genius for a living. What did he contribute to your thinking there?
Well, a lot of hard facts, first of all, because, you know, Simonton has spent the better part of 40 or 50 years studying genius, you know, is a sort of geniusologist. And he has, if he hasn't pioneered, he certainly advanced a rare field called historiometrics, which is looking back at historical events, actually positive events for the most part, and using data to sort of plot them and to make sense of them. So he's put some hard numbers on my hunches, and he does, you know, corroborate the idea that there are these genius clusters and the importance that place plays in all of this.
Mm-hmm. And that got you to thinking about laying out your own global travel escapade, if you will, to study this idea of clusters of creative genius.
Not a bad word.
Yeah, not at all. You came up with a pretty appealing itinerary. Where did you wind up going?
Well, the first problem I had was where to go. And actually, I'll back up a second. The first problem was whether to go anywhere, because unlike my previous books, this was mainly historical. You know, I think we need the distance that time allows to look back and say which places really were places of genius. So with the exception of Silicon Valley, all these places I investigated have come and gone for the most part. You know, Athens. The Athens of today is very different from the Athens of 450 BC. So someone asked me, you know, why travel at all? Well, I do believe there's something to be gained from literally walking in the footsteps of a Socrates. So I had to travel. That's the way I work. It's the way I roll.
Well, what did you get from that
when you went to
Athens?
You get, first of all, you through serendipity, I managed to meet amazing people. My guide for several days in Athens was Aristotle, not the historic Aristotle, but a guide and army dropout and former archaeology student named Aristotle. And that was pretty cool because great serendipity, and he was also offered great insights into the place. So you meet people serendipitously when you travel. And there's something really that's hard to quantify, but I think is very real about breathing the air and walking on the stones. You know, if you think about it, Steve, why does anyone go all the way to Florence or Athens today when all the museum collections are available online? Mm-hmm. You could look at pictures of it. So on one hand, it doesn't make sense why we still go through the ordeal of air travel, you know, in the middle seat to do this. But I get a lot out of it. It focuses my mind. It sparks my imagination. And I get insights that I couldn't get just in the library.
And is that creative vibe, do you pick up on it when you're in a place like Athens today?
Well, you pick up on the embers of the vibe. Mm-hmm. And to some extent, they're still there. But largely, I have to be honest, Athens suffers from what I call a golden age hangover, which is essentially, you know, I talked to someone who's a Greek philosopher today, and a big burden to be a Greek philosopher in the year 2016, because you're not going to do better than Plato and Aristotle and Socrates. And yet there's this expectation that, oh, you're a Greek philosopher. So, you know, every day the Greeks look up in Athens at the Acropolis, which is looking down at them both literally because it's up on a hill, means high place actually, and figuratively because they think, wow, we once were the cradle of civilization and now we're, you know, to be honest, a struggling country, struggling on the edge of the European Union and struggling economically. So these golden ages can have a sort of reverse effect where they actually, I think, put pressure on people today. You know, you don't the worst place to be an artist right now, a young artist right now, is in Florence, probably. Yeah, you're surrounded by all the great art, but it's Michelangelo and Leonardo's work looking at you saying, yeah, what have you done recently?
Yes, I can only imagine. I'm visiting with Eric Weiner about his new book, The Geography of Genius, Lessons from the World's Most Creative Places. So did Dean Key Simonton, then, did he help you plot these different cities that you wound up visiting?
Yes, in that we sort of went through informally some of the places I was considering. And I have to say, this was tough. Sort of coming up with a list of places, or to be honest, narrowing the list down. This could have been a 2,000-page doorstop easily, because there are lots of these places, and you know, I had to make some hard choices. In the end, I chose places that were sort of diverse geographically. So I had, you know, many European places, Athens and Florence and Edinburgh, but also Hangzhou, China in the 13th century, which was a great place of genius that not many people were aware of, or even Calcutta in India in the late 19th, early 20th centuries that saw its own renaissance. And then I was looking for places where the recipe was a little bit different in each place. That's what I was looking for. I didn't want the same recipe to repeat itself. In the end, some places got, you know, dumped I wouldn't say regret, but it was tough. Paris in the 1920s is an obvious place that I could have gone to. But to be honest, when I was researching the book, Woody Allen's movie, Midnight in Paris, I think it's called, had just come out. It was overexposed, I thought. And there are other places I would have liked to have included. But in the end, as a wise man once said, a piece of writing is never finished, only abandoned. So you That's what it comes down to.
Well, as you visited these different places, many of them used to be these beacons of creativity, did it make you feel more creative, or did it make you more creative?
That's a good question. It opened my eyes to the ingredients, and I would say yes, it did make me feel more creative, because I was imbibing the lives of these great people. You know, whether it's Leonardo or the Scottish philosopher David Hume, you know, or Michelangelo, and so you're walking in their footsteps and you're sort of recreating their lives, and so there's a kind of a jolt of energy from that. And I also came to realize really the importance of, I guess, some unusual ingredients, I would say. You know, and the first one I would point out is that these places, almost all of these genius clusters, they were not nice places. They were not, you know, easy, secure, Pacific places. You know, I'm thinking of the sort of biting line that Orson Welles once used to describe Switzerland. He said, 500 years of peace and stability, and what have they brought the world but the cuckoo clock? Which is actually a German invention, so not even that, Steve.
Yes.
Maybe a little unfair to the Swiss, but his point is well taken. That
Very well taken, because you're pointing out that hard times and a little bit of chaos has to be sort of part of the mix here, at least based on some of the history you've looked at.
Yes, and sometimes more than a little bit of chaos. I mean, these places were messy. There was always a mix of cooperation and competition. They were not paradise. In fact, paradise is probably the least creative place in the world, because you don't have any constraints.
And that's just the opposite of what most people probably think about when they think about what you're doing here.
Right. And they think, you know, we have this image of maybe Renaissance Italy as people lounging, eating grapes and creating great art that comes to them very easily. And it didn't come to them easily. Florence was besieged by enemies at the time of the start of the Renaissance. They were just 50 years out from the Black Death, the bubonic plague that decimated the city. And one conclusion that some historians reach, and that I subscribe to, is that the plague actually played a role in the blossoming of the Renaissance, because the city lost a third of its population, and that was tragic, absolutely. But it also shook up the social order. It allowed for more mobility. And sometimes these golden ages are preceded by a great catastrophe.
Well, so what do you think the connection is between hard times and in creativity? Why do you have to have, not saying maybe have to, but why is it so important that in many cases you have this chaos or terrible events happening to spur this kind of creativity?
Well, I think creativity is a response to a challenge, and it's a response to constraints. You know, Robert Frost once said that writing free verse poetry is like playing tennis without a net, right? We need the net, and we need the parameters that, you know, whether it's a haiku or a limerick or whatever, that a poet tries to squeeze his creativity into.
Or a deadline.
A deadline is one of the great motivators. Without them, I don't know if we would have had all the creative genius we've had over the years. And psychologists have done experiments in the lab where they take, a group of people, divide them into two groups. Half are told, you know, make a collage, and here are a bunch of materials to work with, lots of choices, everything you could possibly want to make this collage, and do whatever you want. And the second group is said, well, we're just giving you a few materials, and we're giving you a time constraint, and we're giving you a few options. And it was the second group that produced the more creative collage, because they were working against these constraints. So, you know, think about all corporations today, and frankly, this worries me, who are successful out in California, say in Silicon Valley, and they want to give their employees everything they need to be creative. Mm-hmm. I just hope they include in that constraints, actually, and
that's
challenges. And you know, you can give people too much in a way.
I was going to say that you're sort of answering my question here, but how possible is it then to create these conditions that might wind up spurring genius or creative genius or something close to it?
Well, if I had the answer, if I had that formula, I would not be talking to you now. I'd be on my yacht in the Mediterranean, sipping a drink with an umbrella in it.
Not being creative,
would be, well, creatively mixing my cocktails, but that's about it. Because this question comes up, and I guess that you look at all the attempts to replicate Silicon Valley. There are literally hundreds of them, from Silicon Oasis in the Persian Gulf to Thames Valley in England. And with very, very few exceptions, they have failed spectacularly. And that is because you can't just create these places in the lab, if you will, that they have to grow organically. But having said that, you know, you can – I think of it more as gardening than you know, manufacturing. You know, when you garden, you have the seed, and you want to grow an apple tree. Well, you need the seed. That would be the genetic material. You need the hard work, which is watering the seed. Mm-hmm. But then you need the right soil. And even when you have all that, your apple tree may or may not grow. But I sum it up as the three Ds, and we've sort of discussed most of them so far, which are diversity, discernment, and disorder. Mm-hmm. Diversity is not just ethnic diversity, but intellectual diversity. Discernment is, okay, you got lots of ideas, but they're not all good, you know? Mm-hmm. And Jonas Salk, two-time Nobel Prize winner, was once asked by a student, Dr. Salk, how do you come up with so many good ideas? And he said, well, it's very easy. I come up with lots of ideas and I throw away the bad ones. and then the third is disorder, which we talked about, that chaos. And, you know, there's one neuroscientist calls this the I don't know state. That you have to enter into the I don't know state in order to get to a creative breakthrough. You have to have a tolerance for not knowing. If you think about it, if you think you know everything, if you're convinced you know everything, you're probably not going to be a very creative person.
You also came up with a couple of very practical tips for developing creativity and being creative. You write, for instance, that we do our best thinking while walking. Why is that?
Yes. Why is a good question. The anecdotal evidence are people like Charles Dickens, who walked through the streets of London in the middle of the night when he was stuck, or Mark Twain was a great pacer. Beethoven would go off to the hills and outside of Vienna and come up with his ideas walking in the hills. I think it has to do with what a psychologist calls defocused attention, that we actually come up with our best ideas and we're at our most creative, not when we're sitting at a desk furrowing our brow, but when our attention is actually diffused. And we
have
to
make the same point about ambient noise. That's better than absolute silence, you say. That's interesting to me.
Right. This explains, I think, in large part, the success of Starbucks. Not the coffee, but the ambient noise, mm-hmm. which happens to be pretty close to that perfect amount, 70 decibels, that we are at our most creative at. And walking does the same thing. These are all – or taking a shower. You know, if people mm-hmm. – there are great stories of people having brilliant ideas in the shower. There's nothing special about the shower massager they're using or anything. It's the fact that they're no longer consciously turning over that problem, that question in their mind over and over again. Mm-hmm. So there's something about walking that seems to divert just the right amount of our attention, our conscious attention, away from the task at hand. But unlike something like, I don't know, deadlifting 300 pounds, exercise has benefits, but if you're really intensely into something like that, your ideas may not come to the fore.
Eric Weiner's new book is The Geography of Genius, Lessons from the World's Most Creative Places. He's a former foreign correspondent for NPR. And Eric, so good to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thanks, Steve. I hope you're feeling a little more genius-y after this.
I am, actually. Thank you very much.
Good.
Thanks, Eric.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to look back almost 75 years to Pearl Harbor, 1941. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we are back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we shared private letters of note between the famous and their correspondents. We also looked at more than 80 years of history at UMKC. You can find those conversations online. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we'll be at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art for an exhibition you don't look at, you listen to it. Be sure to join us for that tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at solicitation of Japan, still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack.
And just minutes after President Roosevelt concluded that speech to Congress on December 8, 1941, America was at war with Japan and the Axis Alliance. Tomorrow will mark the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And here to recall it for us is Dr. John Kuhn. He's a retired U.S. Navy commander. He has taught military history at the Command and General Staff College at Fort Leavenworth since 2000, and he's the author of several books, including A Military History of Japan from the Age of the Samurai to the 21st Century. John, welcome to Up to Date. So good to have you here.
Yeah, good morning, Steve. Good to be here.
I want to go back to Roosevelt's speech because he referred to ongoing communication with Japan in an effort to maintain peace in the Pacific. What was the cause of the tensions with Japan to begin with?
Well, the cause of the tensions with Japan was China. It was because of Japan's foreign policy vis-a-vis China since China had broken down into revolution and civil war, and that was the fundamental cause of the problems.
Dr. Kuhn, how much of a surprise then was the attack?
Well, the attack was a surprise in terms of how it was executed and where it was executed, but not the fact that it occurred against the United States or its interests. Roosevelt, the previous day, had told somebody that we might be at war with Japan right now. Nobody could really know, but the tensions were that bad between Japan and the United States that we might already be at war with Japan. And so he had observed that at a party the previous day on Saturday.
I just saw a story on this lingering question, which never seems to go away, of whether President Roosevelt knew that the attack was coming. Is there any reason to think that he did?
I'm with that body of historians who reject the idea that Roosevelt knew an attack on Pearl Harbor was going to occur. I kind of split the middle ground here, though, between those who said he had no knowledge that Japan would probably attack, and again, based on his own commentary, that he fully expected the Empire of Japan to attack the United States and its possessions. It's just that he didn't think that attack could possibly occur at Pearl Harbor, and neither did anybody else in the United States military, with the exception of one man, Admiral J.O. Richardson, who had been fired the previous year by FDR for suggesting that the Pacific Fleet was at risk in Pearl Harbor.
Why did Roosevelt fire him for that?
In 1940, the U.S. Pacific Fleet, in its annual fleet exercises, where it tested fleet doctrine, things like aircraft carrier doctrine, battleship engagement line doctrine, had gone to Hawaii for its annual exercise. And when the fleet was out there, tensions with Japan were already very, very high. Japan had been at war in China now for 3 years. And the United States had increased a sanctions regime against China that included financial and economic measures. And eventually what this would do is this would cause Japan to join the Axis alliance. And so Roosevelt thought maybe he could deter Japan's behavior by sending a signal to Japan by leaving the fleet in Pearl Harbor. And Richardson said Pearl Harbor wasn't ready for the fleet and that the fleet was at risk in Pearl Harbor. Its normal base was San Diego, that the fleet was much better off in San Diego.
And FDR fired him for saying that.
Well, fired is a strong word, and I know I used it, so it's my fault for giving that characterization to it. But essentially, that's what happened. Richardson was removed from command, and a more aggressive man named Husband Kimmel replaced him, Admiral Kimmel. And Richardson was moved back to Washington. And he was employed in other jobs around Washington. In fact, Richardson was still employed by FDR. When FDR died, he was part of something called the General Board of the Navy. Mm-hmm. And eventually he ended up on a committee called the Richardson Board that examined defense unification in 1945. So Richardson never completely went away. He became a big personality at all of the various inquiries after Pearl Harbor. So everybody was very interested in Richardson's take because for precisely the reasons you are, because he had kind of predicted an attack, that Pearl Harbor could be vulnerable to an attack.
So what is the story about FDR perhaps knowing in advance that an attack was coming to Pearl Harbor? You're saying you're not buying that specifically, but why does that story linger so much?
It lingers because it's one of those things post facto we should have known better. Malcolm Gladwell has called this connecting the dots in a famous article in The New Yorker on both 9/11 and Pearl Harbor, and that it seems so obvious that we should have connected the dots afterward, where in point of fact we're really talking about events that are more failures of imagination, but they're understandable failures of imagination. So you have a body of opinion, some of it by the famous American historian Charles Beard, where they said Roosevelt really wanted to come in on the side of the Allies against the Axis in World War II, and this was his chance. And these are Charles Beard's words, the famous historian Charles Beard, that he got the he tricked the Japanese into throwing the first punch. And I don't believe that was the thing. I think there was just a phenomenal misunderstanding between the government of Japan and the government of the United States. They were talking past each other, and the government of Japan had already made the decision to attack Pearl Harbor many weeks before, actually months before. Mm-hmm. But I don't believe. I think Roosevelt thought there would be an attack, but I think he thought it would occur in the Philippines or Guam, and he was right. It did occur in the Philippines and Guam. and it also occurred in British Malaysia.
Just after Pearl Harbor?
Actually, the attack at Malaysia occurred before Pearl Harbor.
Ah, I did not know that.
Yeah. Most people don't, because dates matter and times matter. And so most people forget it's December 8th, remember, on the other side of the international dateline. So they get confused about the sequence of events. But actually, the Japanese invasions in Malaysia are already underway before Pearl Harbor occurs.
But just within hours, though, it sounds like.
Right. This is all synchronization that the Japanese Army and Navy managed in this huge offensive that opened up the Pacific phase of the Greater East Asian War was phenomenal. The Japanese were able to do this was just a phenomenal testament to their planning and professionalism of both their Army and their Navy.
Even wonder little things like the number of planes dive bombing on Pearl Harbor that morning. There were so many. You wonder how they coordinated those attacks, the zeros, to make sure they didn't plow into each other in the air.
That is the subject of a lot of scholarly attention. And I'm in a group with guys like John Parcell, who wrote Shattered Sword, and Alan Zim, who looked at Pearl Harbor again. This is something unique in warfare. And again, it's a failure of imagination, but it's an understandable failure. Nobody had ever demonstrated that you could launch 140 or 120 or 160 airplanes from aircraft carriers and conduct a coordinated strike ever before in the history of warfare. The Japanese did it for the first time at Pearl Harbor. So there's no experience to base an imagination of an attack like this in anything that existed in the military record prior to this. So the Japanese do something that's unique in warfare.
Do we know how they did it, John?
Well, they did it with a lot of practice, training, and secrecy. And ironically, they got the idea from the United States. After the fleet exercise in 1940, where the fleet stayed in Pearl Harbor, they did what we call a photo op in the Navy, where if you have any more than about two carriers together, you form up together and you do a picture. Well, that year, the United States had four aircraft carriers, and they formed them up to a box formation of four aircraft carriers. A newspaperman took a photo. They put it out in the press. The Japanese read the newspaper, saw the picture, and the air officer for the Japanese invasion armada, Kido Butai, the first mobile striking force composed of six aircraft carriers, said the six aircraft carriers worked as two aircraft carrier divisions prior to that. He said, why don't we do what the Americans did, putting four aircraft carriers, except we'll put six aircraft carriers together, and then we'll launch one huge coordinated strike from those six aircraft carriers. And from that point on, they worked towards that goal of getting the training to a peak that they could do that. It's difficult to do such a thing even today with aircraft carriers. So the Japanese accomplishment of this goal is nothing short of incredible. And certainly it's not something anybody could have imagined that they might do. And certainly the Americans would have thought it impossible until it actually happened.
What was it like to be an American sailor in Pearl Harbor on the morning of the attack? Take us there.
Well, they had gotten a war warning from the chief of naval operations that war with Japan was imminent. That came out at the end of November. The two aircraft carriers that were stationed there were deployed to provide supplies and airplanes to Wake Island and Midway Island. So they were out. One of them was under Admiral Halsey, and he basically told his crew, pretend like we're at war. So the guys that were at sea actually were on a war footing.
They were braced for it.
Yeah. So the Enterprise, I think it was the Enterprise and the Lexington, were the two aircraft carrier groups out, and they were on a war footing. The sailors in Pearl Harbor, though, didn't think that they were at risk. That said, there were air patrols to the south where Japanese air attack from the Marshall or the Gilbert Islands might come from, and there were destroyers on patrol at the mouth just in case Japanese submarines were in the area, and they were.
Because everything you read, though, about Pearl Harbor that morning was it was a pretty sleepy Sunday morning.
Right. Everybody had sort of kind of been lulled into a sense of false sense of security. The threat that everybody really thought would be the problem at Pearl Harbor was local domestic terrorism by Japanese-American agents. And so the Army commander and the Navy commander were more worried about domestic sabotage and domestic terrorism against ships and airplanes. That's why the airplanes were lined up in neat little rows, because they were easier to guard that way from terrorists, than they were about Japanese air attack, particularly an air attack from the north, which nobody could have imagined. The Japanese had never demonstrated an ability to drive carriers that far and they had not demonstrated the ability to refuel. And of course, the Japanese learned all of that in the weeks and months preceding Pearl Harbor.
I should point out that Dr. John Kuhn will be speaking tomorrow night at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch, beginning at 6:30. You can reserve a seat at kclibrary.com. You know, the generation of Americans alive at that time, John, my parents included, were forever shaped by those events that began at Pearl Harbor. You know, quite a number of them were still alive on September 11, 2001. What similarities do you see between these two attacks and our country's response to them?
Well, again, I go back to the Malcolm Gladwell thing, but I think the analogy is apt. I've made it myself. I've opened up briefs where I've had the attack at Pearl Harbor with all the battleships burning in flames at the beginning, and at the end I've had the airplanes flying into the World Trade Center to kind of as bookends for some of the talks that I've done on this. So I think it's an apt. I think both events are iconic to the Americans of their generation. And for some Americans, actually, they got to experience, unfortunately, both events. And things changed forever, both before and after both Pearl Harbor and 9/11. So 9/11 is this generation's Pearl Harbor, and it's had it'll continue to have an impact on the way Americans think about themselves and the way they think about their security. Pearl Harbor forever sort of eliminated the idea that we were safe, kind of behind our oceanic bastions and moats. And 9/11 did the same thing, and both attacks were air attacks.
That's interesting. Dr. John Kuhn teaches military history at the Command and General Staff College up at Fort Leavenworth. Again, he speaks tomorrow night at the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, the Central Branch downtown, 6:30. Get a seat, kclibrary.com. Commander John Kuhn, thanks so much. So good to visit with you.
A pleasure to be
Appreciate
here,
it.
Steve. Thank you.
This week's State House Blend, Kansas, features a Johnson County Democrat and a newcomer to the State House of Representatives who ran a campaign that focused on ending what she calls the brownback disaster.
Introduce yourself, please.
Yes, I'm Cindy Holscher, Representative-elect for District 16 in Overland Park, Kansas.
And joining Cindy and me in the KCUR 89.3 production studio is my newsroom colleague, Dan Margulies, who runs our health desk. Dan, nice to have you back at this table.
Nice to be here.
We need to cover a lot of things, taxes, the budget, school funding.
Certainly.
But before we get to all of that, I want to hear what's on Dan's mind. Dan, what do you have for Cindy this morning?
Now, you've never held elected office before.
Correct.
Right? What motivated you to run?
I just couldn't watch it anymore. And I would tell you when 2014 rolled around, we had the elections then. I was kind of hopeful that we would see some of the change then, and it didn't happen the way a lot of us thought it would.
Didn't happen at all, really.
No, it really didn't.
Yeah. So 2014 didn't turn out the way you wanted, but 2016 turned out probably in some might say better, some might say maybe not quite as well as moderates and Democrats would have wanted. But certainly there's a dozen new Democrats coming into the House, one new in the Senate. But I want to concentrate on the House. Also, a lot of new moderates coming in. So there's been a lot of chatter about whether or not there's going to be this Democratic moderate coalition in the House. And I want to know where you think you're going to find common ground with your Republican colleagues.
Well, you know, this is a great time to me in the respect that, yes, the dynamics of the House have changed. We've got a third Democrat, a third moderate, a third that are, you know, some of the returning conservatives. So I absolutely see and hope there's a coalition. I think, I mean, it's already started. So like I said, there's a great coalition of moderates and Democrats who, you know what, we want to move forward. We want to work together. We want to solve some problems.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I need specifics here.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know, let me tick a couple things off. Do you think moderates and Democrats can come together to close the LLC loophole? And I just want to, on full disclosure here, I also take advantage of the LLC loophole. Can you come together and close the loophole?
Oh, I think so. The numbers look good. The numbers of people that I've talked to who indicate that they want to make that happen, that looks very positive.
What about raising the marginal tax rate? Closing the loophole is going to get you some money.
Sure.
May not get you the 300 and Well, 48 right. million you need now. In fact, it probably won't. So you think there'll be an appetite among Democrats and moderates to perhaps raise income tax rates?
For the most part, I'm seeing that people recognize, like you said, the LLC loophole, closing that is not going to do the job. We're going to have to look elsewhere. So I think eyes are open to that.
Yeah. Let's talk about school finance. I mean, if there was an issue that dominated Johnson County politics, maybe even Northeast Kansas politics, since the beginning of the year, it's schools and school finance. You're looking at having to write a new school funding formula. I understand that there's been some work on that. Have you been privy to any of that pre-work?
Not really. No. I mean, I've heard different things, but no.
Yeah. What do you think has to be in a new school funding formula?
You know, I think we have to take a look first. What do we want from it? You know, there's talk of adequacy. Yet, I can't say that in talking to parents and talking to administrators that adequacy is really what we want. I hear that we want better than just adequate. That we like great technology for our kids. We like top-notch teachers. We like great programs. So I think we all do need to come together and figure out what it is we want and work from there.
Right. But the fact is that it's all going to be, and you know, the State Board of Education has come up with some pretty lofty goals. They've increased, I think, what they consider passing or adequate on state standardized testing. And so, as you look forward, I'm going to ask about a couple of specific things. You hear a lot about what the previous formula had, and that was weighting, right, so that you can adequately. I want to go back to some of the politics that we're going to see in the House from your view. But before we move away from policy, I want to hear a discussion from you two about mental health problems in Kansas, a rat's nest of problems at Osawatomie and Larned. Mm-hmm. Police departments, the Johnson County Sheriff's Department, dealing with mental health issues. I think that's going to be an important topic. I think it's crucial to fix. So let's talk about that a little bit. Dan, where do you think we are, and where we're going to go with this?
Effectively, many of our jails have become warehouses for the mentally ill because we haven't allocated the resources, financially and otherwise, mm-hmm. necessary to treat the mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And Osawatomie is simply the tip of the iceberg. Osawatomie losing its Medicaid certification and losing $1 million a month, that's a terrible thing. The state is trying to fix it, and I think it will eventually fix that problem there. But that is just one aspect of a systemic problem throughout the state. And I will say that we posted a story this morning about the Cures Act that Representative Yoder and Representative Jenkins from Kansas have been instrumental in crafting parts of, that includes a big mental health component. But there is a lot that needs to be done, clearly.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've seen funding cuts, yet the people who need those services don't just disappear. I mean, right. And you're right. Then it flows over to the jails, that type of thing. And, you know, just the other night we were talking about, you know, how much money it costs for a person who needs mental health services to be jailed.
Yeah.
And obviously it's another one of those situations where can we make the investment somewhere else better and more effectively, more cost effectively, get the right treatment and do a better job with this versus, again, letting them end up in jail when they need treatment. That's not the place where some of these individuals need to be. And it's very cyclical, in and out of jail, not getting the progress that is needed.
Given everything else, do you think there'll be a run in the House to try to find additional funding or fix some of these problems? Or are you going to be bogged down with taxes, with school finance, mm-hmm. and we're going to talk about those, but, mm-hmm. you know, it seems guns. Do you think that there'll be a run to try to address mental health?
The desire is certainly there, but you're right. I mean, the two things that have to be addressed right away, the two biggies are the tax situation as well as public school financing.
I don't want to get away without discussing whether or not you think there'll be a run at rolling back the law that is going to allow guns, not just on college mm-hmm. campuses. Mm-hmm. I think that's the most that's what gets the most ink, of course, but in any public building, mm-hmm. right? So, do you think there's going to be a run at that, and do you think that the legislature will roll that back?
I think it's quite possible, and you're right. It's the part about the guns on campus that gets the most attention, because even talking to people who are very strong about the gun rights and everything, they're still like, but the guns on campus. I mean, it's that's the part that bothers even the strongest mm-hmm. in that arena. So I do think that's possible. I do hear a lot about local control, too,
yeah.
As far as, you know, local governments being able to make the decision and the fact of, you know, how much overreach is too much overreach from the state.
And not just about guns, but on property sure. taxes as well.
Yeah.
You're hearing that as well from
certainly.
From local. Okay. Dan Margulies, your final thought or question for Cindy Holscher.
Yes, we were talking earlier about the wave of Democrats and moderate Republicans who are going to be coming into office, including yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Governor Brownback insists the elections were not a referendum on his leadership. What do you think?
Trying to choose my words correctly here. you know, our revenues are horrible, yet there's not an acknowledgement. So it's probably a continuation of that same strategy that he's going to continue to operate the way that he has been, while not necessarily, you know, seeing some of the information that's out there. I think, is that the most polite way I could put it?
I don't know, is it? would you like to revise and extend your remarks? No?
I think I'll stick with what I said.
Then we shall leave it there. Representative-elect Cindy Holscher, this is where we turn the podcast completely over to you, and you are going to decide what music we will walk off with. So what song is rolling through your head right now?
Sesame Street. That's really my three
love it.
Kids.
That's great.
Cindy Holscher goes with a theme from Sesame Street.
Well, no, it's a great
can
song.
Can you give me some ideas? God.
It could be your favorite song. Is there whatever you heard on the radio? But
I love
I have
that
to
song.
Say, Sesame Street is not a bad choice. Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. I'm Sam Zeff. I'll see you around the radio.
Find full episodes of the Statehouse Blend Kansas podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, be sure to subscribe to Statehouse Blend Missouri as well. You can listen to previous programs and download our podcast. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR UpToDate. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting live from the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art to talk about an exhibit you have to hear to believe. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Ryan Hennessy. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.